This is Louder Than Words, the pod from the University of Essex. I'm Professor Jules Pretty.
I'm journalist Martha Dixon. In this episode, we're putting the spotlight on mental health.
UK health data shows that many mental illnesses start young. According to the World Health Organization, around a fifth of children and young adults around the world have a mental ill health condition.
But there are big shifts in policy taking place, including how to treat and prevent problems.
When you're meditating, you can put everything aside and concentrate and think about anything you want, so you become calmer.
We'll be looking at what's happening on the ground, especially in new teaching and training methods for those who treat people suffering from mental illness.
We use mindfulness in practice. We look at a lot of other more contemporary therapies as well.
And we'll learn how philosophy tools developed at the University of Essex are making a big difference for patients and their freedom to choose what happens to them.
Social care in the 21st century should be about the maximization of autonomy. That's a new idea, and it's also a philosophical idea. What is it? Is it autonomy is a kind of freedom.
In recent decades, there has been a philosophical shift in mental health care. This approach focuses on the individual as a whole, rather than just their diagnosis.
Busy completing her studies to become a mental health nurse, this is Hannah Brock, who's at the University of Essex.
For example, if you have depression, and are experiencing...
She'll be treating people with conditions like anxiety, depression and schizophrenia.
I think it's a really exciting time to be studying mental health at the moment because I think sort of our attitude as a society is changing and we're not really shying away from those difficult conversations anymore.
Hi Sarah, it's Hannah from the Community Mental Health Team. Is now a good time to talk?
Hi, yeah, okay.
Part of Hannah's studies involve practice role plays with other students.
Okay, yeah.
Great, okay. So we've discussed a bit already about your previous medical history and any sort of treatments you've had before. So today I really want to hear from you about what you think your main difficulty is.
I guess my main issue is that I just feel really low. I can't stop crying and I just feel like I just don't want to talk to anyone or see anyone.
Okay, thank you for sharing that. How long have you been experiencing this, would you say?
Hannah knows there's been a great shift in treating mental illness in the last 20 to 30 years. And she's now learning how she can prescribe exercise, creative projects and being in nature.
I think we kind of understand that mental health affects everything, whether that's relationships or jobs or our physical health. So when we understand how it affects everything, we can better support people and treat them more holistically. So that's sort of what we've been learning about at university. There's so many more available options now, and there's something for everyone, I think. So whether that's you want to talk to someone and just talk out sort of any issues that you're having, or whether you want to channel that more creatively, so you want to do some music or art, or if you want to sort of focus on it as a family and you can go to family therapy, there's so many options that I think that's another reason why it's such an exciting time to be doing it now, because we have that chance to be more creative and we have that chance to kind of explore different options with the patient based on their preferences.
Their preferences. This concept is also a key cornerstone in today's treatments.
This marks another important shift in UK policy on mental illness.
I like to say we're in a slow motion revolution in care contexts, including mental health care contexts.
Professor Wayne Martin from the University of Essex uses his philosophy research to help this revolution here in the UK.
I direct a project called the Essex Autonomy Project, which is a research project and public policy project that focuses on the ideal of self-determination in care settings. Really starting after the war, Nuremberg, There was more and more of an emphasis on human rights and self-determination as being important values in care settings. And so that's been a process that's been changing. If you think back before that, you might have a more of a model of doctor knows best, you know, follow doctor's orders. But we think now more of a kind of partnership between care providers and care recipients. And so that's autonomy. That's trying to build in the value of autonomy into care settings and to re-regulate care practices in conformity with that kind of ideal.
Wayne's groundbreaking work is about helping decision makers ensure mental health patients are very much involved in their own treatment processes, and they have the free will to make choices.
Some of the ideas that inform care practice and the regulation of care, the adjudication of care relationships, they are philosophical ideas. There's a famous Department of Health memo from 2010 that says, you know, social care in the 21st century should be about the maximization of autonomy. That's a new idea, and it's also a philosophical idea. What is it? Is it autonomy is a kind of freedom. Freedom in philosophy, that's one of the things we worry about. What is freedom? So what does that mean concretely, and how does one embed it into new kinds of care practices? So that's the kind of philosophical angle on this. A lot of our practice, is, as well as the kind of strictly academic side of it, is focused on providing training for professionals. There are a lot of professional roles in British life that in one way or another are responsible for ensuring respect for autonomy and human rights in care settings. So one obvious example is judges. There's a specialist court called the Court of Protection that is involved in the regulation of care practices. And judges need training. So one of the things that our team does is we build curricula and deliver training to judges. But judges is just one example. You think about social workers or what are called advocates. There's a special role called best interests assessors in care home settings.
Well, I would like to think that we are definitely holistic, Martha.
With the increased prevalence of mental illness in the UK, there's a real need for new and proven methods like autonomy and social treatments to become cornerstones of all training for practitioners.
That's where Thomas Currid comes in.
He runs the course for mental health nurses at the University of Essex.
He says he's adopted a very different approach in recent years, making him part of the revolution in mental health care.
Whilst years ago, I do understand that, you know, mental illness was treated very much in the medical model, in the biomedical model, that, you know, for example, it was seen as having some kind of organic, and it, you know, does have an organic basis, but also that it was seen as, you know, being able to be treated by, we say, medicines alone, or, you know, even surgery, for example. So over the years, things have improved because people have, you know, thought about this and thought, well, hold on a minute. What about their social aspect and what about their psychological aspect?
This new teaching approach that includes autonomy and social treatments is something Thomas sees as a great benefit for patients.
Yes, we still use physical. For example, we will use medication, but we also understand that people do have many other domains that are really important, and it's these domains that are, you know, that will enable the person to enjoy life. And we're about ensuring the individual that we care for, we want them to flourish rather than languish. So yes, over the years it has definitely, there's been a move from the more biomedical model to the more biopsychosocial model. And, you know, if you think about many of the approaches that are currently in use, we're now, you know, going to, you know, other areas, so such as mindfulness, for example. We use mindfulness in practice. We look at a lot of other more contemporary therapies as well.
The new landscape for mental illness in the UK includes autonomy for patients and social treatments. But what about preventative care before people end up with the NHS?
Figures show the majority of mental health patients develop their conditions when they are young.
Meditation is proven to help children, but it's falling to charities to provide the service in schools.
From the tip of your head to the bottom of your feet, my entire body is comfortable.
Like this one in Northwold Primary in London.
When you're meditating, you can put everything aside and concentrate and think about anything you want, so you become calmer.
It helps me take a calmer approach and helps me just calm myself down, take a little breather, and it just helps me get on with my work and makes me more peaceful.
My name's Srivati and I'm part of Breathing Space in Schools, and what we do is we teach mindfulness to both pupils and their adults in schools. So we're connected with the London Buddhist Centre, which has a secular mindfulness programme also called Breathing Space. But our focus is definitely bringing this life skill to young people. Well, one of the things we've learnt through just being young people ourselves and those of us who teach young people is that, like us adults, they struggle often with the same kind of things. They might get anxiety. Quite a lot of them suffer from depression, which is worrying in itself. And just having trouble coping with difficult situations on an ordinary level. And so those of us adult practitioners of mindfulness, we found it helpful for us. And so wanting to share it with young people.
Meditation has made me calmer during work, and when someone annoys me, I don't rush off. I just meditate and it all feels better.
It helps me to focus, and when you come back from in the playground, you can calm down and you're in a state where you can finish and do your work and continue in a calm state.
It's been great. I think it is part of the bigger picture of mental health. The incidence of depression in people is starting much younger. So the earlier you start to experience depression, the more of your life you're going to be struggling with it. So to have these tools of mindfulness when you're young is going to be really helpful to offset that repeating.
And this approach is also being embraced by Essex academic Caroline Barrett. She's a pioneer of a method called contemplative pedagogy.
So contemplative pedagogy is a way of approaching teaching and learning that really embraces the inner experience of students. So very often in higher education, we're very much focused on teaching students about the world around them. But by bringing in contemplative practices into the classroom and into the way that we teach and help our students learn, we can support them to become aware of what's going on for them in their own minds, in their own hearts, and connect with their own sense of value and where they want to go in the world.
So Caroline, what does taking part in this practice actually mean if you're at university or college?
So sometimes it might include something like a short mindfulness practice at the start of a class to help students become more focused. For example, we might ask them to spend a few minutes just focusing on their breath to help them calm down and settle as they arrive in the classroom. Or it might include something, a more reflective space in which students are really asked to perhaps write about or talk about how they're being affected by what they're learning and their experience of that. And they might share that with colleagues or they might keep it to themselves. It's about introducing students to their own minds. So very often in education, we just take it for granted that students have minds that are capable of learning. And we often come across this model where we think of ourselves as teachers and filling up the minds of our students, if you like, with new information. But actually, the each student will have a very, very different subjective experience of learning. Each student is bringing a very different range of conditions into the classroom with them. And so by allowing space within the classroom activities for students to become aware of how they're being affected by what they're learning and the things that their mind is doing while they're trying to learn, I think it's very empowering. It enables students to notice when they have kind of emotional blocks to learning or perhaps where they're becoming very distracted. And then it gives them tools to help them overcome that. It's really about developing awareness, I think, that enables students to then make positive changes and learn more effectively and more deeply and in ways that will help them to see the world more differently. In a way, it's a new thing. But historically, university education was very open to these ways of teaching and learning when it first developed. But over time, we've become more technically focused, if you like. And I think the contemplative aspects of learning have somewhat been lost.
Caroline has established a new organisation of educators, spreading the word that good mental health equals good learning.
I've now set up a network called the Contemplative Pedagogy Network that's connecting UK educators, although now it also has a global audience, because I wanted to connect with educators that were interested in exploring these ways of teaching and learning, because it felt really novel to me and very unknown. And so now we have quite a strong network of educators working in lots and lots of different fields and asking questions about, well, how do we apply this in economics? How do we apply this in maths? How do we apply this in sociology? Right across the board. And that's a really interesting exploration for me.
This type of mental health practice is becoming more widespread in the UK, but often those on the front line of helping people with mental illness don't have this kind of support or extensive training to draw on. They're also often on low pay.
But yeah, we were saying earlier in the team meeting that she's going to need a lot of like structure and routine and a lot more staff attention as well, which we anticipate might be an issue for the other young person.
These workers in a children's home are talking about the complex needs of the young people they care for. Chris Nicholson from the University of Essex is here to help with guidance.
So my sense is this is autism quite high on the spectrum rather than...
She's not high.
She's higher functioning, but she's, although she is reflective and has social skills, it's more towards adults.
Chris wants all care workers in this country to have a better toolbox to be able to cope with complex situations often connected with mental health.
Okay. Well, so she's very good,
And the need for structure can be good.
Because there's a whole range of different skills that practitioners need to have. And one of the problems in the, let's say, if I speak very broadly, the social care sector, including all of these therapeutic and mental health services, not just adult elderly care, which is often thought of as social care, but much more broadly. And we've got a real problem in that sector, which is that we we've seen it now through coronavirus and the impact on key workers. We've seen some of the problems that they're not given enough training, they're not paid enough, they're not given enough kudos. And in the UK, you don't even have to have a degree to go into that work. It's as though human nature and working with other human beings is simple work. And it's far from simple, unfortunately. If you were living in Sweden or some of the other European countries, you would be taking a degree to go into that field, and it's very much more respected and facilitated.
Chris has set up one of the first degree courses to give care workers the skills they need. He's encouraging others to follow.
So in this country, it's very disparate. There's not enough training, and therefore people do actually need knowledge. So there should be a syllabus that might include human development, it might include psychodynamic processes and concepts, it may include therapeutic work one-to-one and in groups. It certainly needs to include organisational dynamics, very important. And one of the key things, skills, is to do with observation. And there are two elements of observation. One of them is the observation of the other. and that is your clients and your colleagues, and learning to observe and think about that. The other observation is of yourself, isn't it? And that's what we call reflective practice. So these components need to be built into any kind of training. And uniquely, one of the courses that we developed in our department of psychosocial and psychonic studies is a course called Therapeutic Communication and Therapeutic Organizations, which is an FDA designed around people that work full time. So it's quite unique in that sense. And that really brought into the university a lot of students who are working in social care and in these quite complex settings who had never before had an opportunity to do a degree. So it's been a really wonderful thing. And of course, then we teach these students, and that's been something that I've been doing for many, many years. And we learn an incredible amount from them, because in a way they're bringing live material from the sector into the seminar room every week. And so it's fascinating not only for them to apply the psychodynamic ideas to their work, which they find has great efficacy, but also for us to learn a lot more about what's happening in the sector now. So that's a real problem that sector's not well provided for by government in terms of education and training.
We do hope you've enjoyed Louder Than Words, the podcast from the University of Essex.
In this episode, we've heard how mental health needs are becoming more recognised in every part of UK society, from young children to university students and to those who care for others with mental health conditions. Thank you for listening. This was the Louder Than Words podcast from the Centre for Public and Policy Engagement at the University of Essex. You'll find links to the contributors and their work and books on the Centre's website.